Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 4th of August. The amount of money we spend in this country on complementary health approaches is what we're talking about this hour. According to a study by the National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health, Americans spent $30.2 billion, $28 billion for adults and about almost $2 billion for children, in out-of-pocket complementary health approaches. This was a nationwide survey, and the approaches include a diverse medical and healthcare systems, a group of them, and products such as herbal supplements, meditation, chiropractic, and yoga. The amount represents 9.2% of all out-of-pocket spending by Americans on healthcare and 1.1% of total healthcare spending. Here to talk about the whole topic is Dr. David Shurtleff. He is Deputy Director of the National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health. The National Center's mission is to define, through rigorous scientific investigation, the usefulness and safety of complementary and integrative health approaches and their roles in improving health and health care. Dr. Shurtleff has been with the National Institutes for Health for some 19 years and has done a lot of research on drug abuse, addiction, and treatment of those. He was at the National Institute on Drug Abuse as acting director for some time. We'll be welcoming phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. I'm sure you'll have a lot to say about this issue because many people are spending a lot of money on all of these complementary approaches to keeping healthy. Dr. David Shurtleff, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you here. So you did this study. Were you surprised by how much money we spend on this?
Yes, we were. I mean, this is really helping us sort of think about the research we need to do here at the NIH. As you know, just to give some background, we are part of the National Institutes of Health, which is the nation's medical research agency, making important discoveries that improve health and save lives and turning discovery into health. And, of course, NCCIH is the institute at the NIH that is focusing on complementary and integrative health approaches that include yoga, tai chi, mind-body approaches in general, and the use of natural products. So we're very interested in this study to help sort of think about where our research should be going. And $30.2 billion, it doesn't sound like a lot when you think about the $2.8 trillion that's spent on healthcare in the United States, but when you dig a little deeper, it is 9.2% of the out-of-pocket healthcare expenditures in the U.S. So that was significant for us.
Mm-hmm. So most insurance doesn't cover many of these practices, right?
That's true. In some cases, depending on the state, depending on the insurance company, chiropractic may be covered. In fact, a study showed that some of chiropractic was in fact covered in studies we've done before. But in general, you're right, Kathleen, many of these are out-of-pocket expenses. And it was interesting to note that the average cost per person was about $510 per person, which seems like a lot, and it really didn't matter on the level of income across family household income. So that was interesting to us as well.
That does seem like a lot of money, $510 per person. And do you know where the money is going? Is it going to herbal supplements mostly?
It really depends. A lot of it went for natural products. Again, about a third of the out-of-pocket expenditures for natural products relative to, about 24%, about a quarter for natural products. That's compared to prescription drugs expense. So, it's a significant amount for natural products. The most money went for practitioners, visiting practitioners services. That was about a third of all practitioners' out-of-pocket expenditures were for complementary health practitioner visits and service. So that was very interesting to us. It suggests that people are seeing value in these approaches. The question, of course, is balancing whether, in fact, they are effective and safe with people using these interventions. And that's really the mission of us here at the NIH, is to understand what is safe and effective.
Right. I was amazed by the amount of money spent on children. I don't know what they're using, but $2 billion we're spending a year on children. Where's it going?
Yeah, a lot. It's really across the board. It was equally spent on visits. It was really equally. We looked at visits to health to complementary health professionals. That was about $500 million. Expenditures on natural products for children was about $800 million. And then self-care, you know, videos and CDs for learning about mind-body intervention, such as meditation, that was about $500 million for children. So it was sort of equally split across all these interventions. And interesting that children are using them. And again, we don't really have a lot of data on their effectiveness and safety in children. We have some more in adults, but the research with children, that's true for other drugs, prescription drugs as well. There's a little less research on really what works and what doesn't and what's safe and effective in children. So an area that requires a lot more research. But interesting to know that we need to do more work in that area given the amount of use, right? Almost $2 billion.
Right. Yeah. So given the fact that we don't have a whole lot of research showing effectiveness of a lot of this, why is it we spend so much money on it?
Yeah, again, I think people are finding value. I hope that they're going to our website. I'll put a plug in that for www.nih.ncch.gov because we do, as a research-based organization, we provide the most objective information on as many health practices as we have research available, whether it's natural products or mind-body. So I hope people are doing their homework, I guess, when they think about using these approaches.
Mm-hmm. I remember doing a show not that long ago, which was so eye-opening for me. It was a PBS special that was done that looked at lack of regulation, really, of the supplement business and how so many of these products maybe don't even have the ingredient in it that is supposed to be effective for whatever it is that ails you. And in some cases, they've been dangerous.
Well, right. There are health alerts that come out and warnings through both our website and the Federal Food and Drug Administration. So if people are thinking about using a particular product, they should, you know, go to our site, which does give some key points about and warnings about certain natural products. And, of course, the FDA is on top of this as well. But you're right. Dietary supplements are not drugs. They're not regulated the same way as prescription drugs. So it is important that people be cautious and do their homework before taking any natural product.
Should they be regulated, and why aren't they?
Well, you know, this is a long history that really goes beyond what NIH is involved with. We're more concerned about the research, and our research really informs people about what is safe. But this regulation has been in effect since, I believe, the late 90s, and does treat dietary supplements different from prescription drugs. And we're seeing that where there's really problems in the area of bodybuilding, sexual enhancement, and weight loss, where, you know, it's the Wild West out there, Kathleen, and I think people need to do their homework before they think about using these products.
Evidently, we don't do our homework, do we?
Well, that's why we're here. You know, that's why NCCIH is here. We do research, and we have a very able staff, our communication staff, putting up the latest and greatest information on many of the approaches that you and your audience may be interested in. And I just, again, want to put a plug in for nccih.nih.gov as a way to get that information, objective, unbiased information. Much of what's out on the Internet, as you probably know, is commercial-based and may not have the evidence that's needed. And, of course, there are some benefits to what we what people use and support, particularly in our mind-body. We know that yoga, Tai Chi has major benefits. Some natural products, depending, can be useful, but people really do need to do their homework, and hopefully our website and information we provide can help people make informed decisions.
I was interested in the research you've done on drug abuse and addiction and treatment of drug abuse and addiction. Do you find that complementary medicine is in that area as well?
It's moving more in that direction, Kathleen. That's an excellent question. You know, for the most part, there are no available medications for treating substance abuse. There are, as you know, with the opiate epidemic, there is opiate replacement therapy. Methadone, buprenorphine has been shown to be very effective. But behavioral interventions have a major role to play in treating drug abuse and addiction, and mind-body type approaches can be helpful. We're doing research to in fact determine whether that's the case, but preliminary data suggests that there is a role for what we call mind-body or behavioral interventions, such as cognitive behavioral therapy and other behavioral approaches, that may be as beneficial or at least now more beneficial than what we can do with medication. So it's an ongoing area of research, but there's a lot of hope and promise using behavioral-based approaches. And NCCIH, working closely with the National Institute on Drug Abuse, is looking at some of those research areas in more detail.
I'm absolutely flabbergasted, and I don't know if you have figures on this, by the number of books. I don't know if there are as many coming out now as there used to be, but the whole industry of diet books and is huge, isn't it? I mean, it seems as though every 3 weeks or so, some years ago, there would be a new diet that would come out and a big fad, and somebody would essentially kind of make it up.
Well, right. I think that's, again, where the need for research is so important. And, you know, we at the NIH, as you know, is made up of 27 centers and institutes. One of the major institutes here is the National Institute on Kidney and Digestive Disease. And they are really looking at the whole issue of obesity and diet and other interventions that may be important for treating obesity and overeating. And certainly the role of, we are doing work on mind-body approaches, meditation, contemplative practices that may actually help people do better in thinking about self-control and what they eat and how they eat. And that is an ongoing area of research for us.
Mm-hmm.
Very important given the state of the American population and obesity in this country.
Right. Well, Dr. Shirt, let's give us a better understanding of the kind of research that's going on in all of these areas. What kind of research is being done on supplements, on yoga, on meditation, on acupuncture, on massage?
Yeah, it's a great question, Kathleen. I mean, we really we have a modest budget here at the NCCIH, but we really do cover the realm of research from natural products, basic science, through clinical research. Similarly for our mind-body portfolio, research portfolio, again, from basic understanding of how these meditative contemplative practices may change the brain, for example, to how they may be integrated into healthcare. So it's a very broad spectrum of research that we support. It's exciting research. We're one of the few. We may be small, but in terms of overall investment across the world, we're probably the largest institute investing in complementary and integrative health. So it's an exciting time. We're seeing starting to see some fruits of the research that we do, and we just keep pushing and further to understand. And of course, our goal is to improve public health.
Mm-hmm. So would you go so far as to issue a report on some kind of supplement that you found was not worth its paying a penny for? On the other hand, publish a report saying that yoga may be very beneficial for your health. Do you go that far?
Exactly. I mean, well, we sort of let the data dictate where we go. The research dictates what we can say about particular interventions for particular conditions. And there's many ways we gather information. As you and your audience may be familiar with the Cochrane Review, the group that really does an outstanding job in reviewing the extant literature, the existing literature on particular area of science in complementary and integrative health that provides the latest updated information. And as you probably know too, research is imperfect. Sometimes a study will come out and positive, sometimes negative, and it's really the body of the evidence over time that really helps us decide on what the risks and benefits are for any intervention. And that's just the nature of the scientific method and how it progresses and moves forward. And we just here at NCCIH try to live up to the highest standards of rigor and reproducibility in conducting that research.
Mm-hmm. And when we started talking about the $30.2 billion out of pocket on complementary health, is that figure, Dr. Shurtleff, going up year by year?
That's a great question. We've done this now, and this study, just to give you a little bit of background, it's the National Health Interview Survey, which is actually conducted by the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, every year. And every 5 years, we attach a supplement survey on complementary and integrative health. So in 2007, with a similar set of questions, we found that, in general, the expenditure stayed relatively the same. What did go up was that there was more spending on seeing providers. So that's really new information and something that we didn't see in 2007. But to get to your question, it's been relatively over from 2007 to 2012, the amount of out-of-pocket expenditures was relatively the same.
We're going to welcome phone calls, and here's how you reach the conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655. You can send an email, talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page, where we like to get your messages always, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Our guest is Dr. David Shurtleff. He is Deputy Director of the National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health. And we're looking at a survey that was done showing the amount of money that Americans spend on complementary health approaches. And that includes a number of different things, herbal supplements. It includes meditation, chiropractic, yoga, massage, and other areas. They're doing research to determine the effectiveness of the complementary medicine as well. And I also want to talk about a movement, because it would appear that over the past few years, insurance companies have been covering much more of the complementary approach. Some have and some haven't. Is there a great move on the part of companies to include and a desire for insurance companies to include these kinds of complementary medicine techniques? Well, let's go to your phone calls, and we'll do it just momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. David Shurtleff, Deputy Director of the National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health, is our guest this hour. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. And we start our calls with Terry in Waupaca. Hi, Terry.
Hi. The reason I go outside of the normal medical community is because I find I don't get help. And as an example, in 2002, I woke up one morning and I just felt not myself. I had no energy, whatever. It took till 2007 before I was diagnosed with a thyroid disorder. And then they put me on Synthroid. But it took about till 2010 before I never felt any better. It took till 2010 till they finally told me it was autoimmune thyroid. And then they still didn't change any medication. So I think as a patient, you have to take control of your own health care, because if you don't, you aren't getting help. I finally found a functional medicine nurse practitioner who actually helped me. And my thyroid now, I've adjusted my what I eat. So I've changed what I eat. I do take supplements, but I take good quality supplements. And my thyroid is no longer autoimmune, but it's because I went outside the traditional medicine, and that's why. And I'm having to pay all this stuff out of pocket. But what's the point of paying a doctor or going to a doctor just because it's in your health care plan if you're not getting help?
Dr. Shurtleff.
Yeah, I'm glad you were able to figure out exactly what was wrong. I think that's wonderful. I'm sorry it sounded very frustrating. And I think you're right. I mean, there is more. I think patients do need to take a role in how they in their own care, and I commend you for doing that. And again, that's part of our mission here at the NCCIH, is to really provide information to the public and practitioners about the benefits. At least in our case, I can't speak to all the conventional medicine, but certainly for complementary and integrative health, that is really one of our major goals, is to provide the most recent, current, research-based, unbiased information about complementary and integrative health practices, both for the public, by the way, but also for practitioners. We have a clinician's digest that we put out every month on specific topics. So we are right with you on realizing that patients and physicians need to be informed as much as possible about the latest research that can be useful in making diagnoses and recommending treatment.
Dr. Shurtleff, what about the number of people who may go to some complementary practices that may be less than helpful, simply because through perhaps lack of funding or just that some diseases are very hard to figure out, that you have cancer and you can't get a treatment that's going to give you much relief, and so people try all kinds of things to feel better. Does that fuel a lot of the money that is spent on complementary health or not?
That's a good question, Kathleen. We didn't quite get into those details, but you bring up a good point that a lot of the complementary and integrative health approaches we study are studied in cancer patients, not to treat the cancer itself. I might make clear there's no complementary integrated approach that has been shown to be effective in treating or curing cancer. But as you know, and I know personally, having family members who have gone through and dealt with cancer, there's a lot of stress, anxiety, and emotional distress that's associated with cancer. And complementary and integrated approaches is one area we're studying to see if, in fact, they can benefit those aspects, those symptoms associated with cancer, to help improve patients' outcomes, reduce stress and anxiety, which in the long run could benefit the effectiveness of the conventional treatment.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much, Terry, for your call. Elizabeth is next. Hi.
Hi. I like to think of myself as working in two different languages of medicine, which is conventional and also traditional. So kind of want to make an observation, a statement for coming from both directions. I work with whole plant formulas, but I should be able to make them myself here, but I can't because I do need to meet the FDA dosha laws. So I do. So I have them outsourced with a contract manufacturer at a nutraceutical company. And I have to object to the idea that it's a total wild west. Everything I do is tested again and again at every juncture. So right now I have something ready to be released, but it's being tested in a lab to make sure that everything that I say is in it is in it. And I think that some of the hoo-ha, maybe about a year ago in the fall, had to do with the fact that one of the problems with some of the testing was that they were testing for phytochemicals that are used for species authentication that aren't necessarily the phytochemicals that we're going to be extracting and using in a given supplement. So it led to a lot of confusion in the marketplace. It's a little too complicated for people to understand easily, and it really led to a lot of misunderstanding and suspicion that's not accurate. The other thing I would say is, coming from my place as a traditional practitioner, is that if we're strictly looking at saying that we need to have a science-based evidence before we're going to use any kind of treatment, we're really going to stop ourselves up, because so much of what we're looking at and we eventually find and understand and are able to explain and find good documentation and support of starts with people insisting on using their traditional practices and their traditional remedies. And one area of science that was heavily dragged along by traditional medicine is the understanding of the gut and the impact of the gut on your mental health and your immune system and the probiotics and the biome. All of that had been living in the world of, quote, alternative medicine for a long, long time, forever, until it kind of got dragged to the surface because people just refused to stop doing it. So I think it's a really dangerous idea to insist that we need to prove methods of healing ourselves effective scientifically before people do it.
Dr. Shurtleff.
Right. So, Elizabeth, thank you for your comments. I think you raised some interesting and important points. First, I think when I meant the Wild West, a lot of the information on the web about the benefits or the potential health benefits of natural products can be at times overstated without the basic science information. When it comes to the purity of natural products, you're absolutely right. The FDA does require good manufacturing practices, or GMP, and for the most part, especially in the United States, and I commend you for taking the effort to do that in a very rigorous way. Unfortunately, a lot of these products come in from outside the United States or elsewhere, and that they not always live up to the same GMP standards that are required, and that's why these health warnings do come out at times about the toxicity of particular natural products. When it comes to thinking about the science base for treating individuals, I agree with you. It works both ways. Clinical observation can lead to further scientific research that can actually improve upon what's observed in the clinic. My only point being is that if there is information out there that's evidence-based and unbiased, that people should take that into account when making any health decision. And, of course, it works both ways. Getting back to your point about the gut-brain axis, we at NCCI said it's one of the areas of research, because it is sort of a little bit outside the mainstream, we are actually actively involved in studying that aspect of use of probiotics and the what we call the gut microbiome and how that can influence the brain. And it's a very fascinating area. It's a very innovative area of research. Still a lot of unknowns, but here again, where some observation in the clinic can help guide future research that could further improve upon treatments and progress research forward. So I see it as a two-way street, that clinical observation can help inform basic science that can further inform clinical research, and both are critically important.
It does leave the consumer a bit confused, though, doesn't it? This whole probiotic thing has become somewhat of a debate, too. The whole gluten-free, we did a program on that recently, how many products now are saying gluten-free, even though they don't have gluten in them, and the number of people who are not eating gluten who have no reason to not do that. It's difficult because you want really pure scientific evidence, which, I don't know, maybe it's hard to get, but so that you know whether or not this works.
Right. I could see it's frustrating to people, you know, trying to figure out what's best for them and their families. But I think we all appreciate, unfortunately, the science takes time, and answering complex questions takes more time than we would hope. But just thinking about the microbiome and probiotics, there are more microbes in our body than cells, which the number and diversity of those microbes is quite unique, depending on the individual, where they live, what they eat, and then to try to sort all that out and figure out what is the best probiotic for an individual for a particular condition, you can imagine the complexity.
Right.
It's a really exciting area. NIH overall is spending a lot of money looking at the microbiome. We're just right now on a 10-year microbiome initiative just to look and categorize what is the genotype of these microbes in the body, not just in the gut, but in the mouth, on the skin. Every microbe population is different, and how that impacts health, how that can improve upon disease is fascinating, and an area we're really moving headlong into, and I think we'll have some answers soon.
Elizabeth, thanks for your call. Ruth in Altoona, hi.
Hi. Calling, I appreciate all the conversation here, and I think, you know, another area for people is, you know, our healthcare system is so focused on illness versus staying healthy, and that creates problems all by itself. But the other thing for me is the lack of concern and research sort of to really warn people about the effects of too much sugar and too many simple carbohydrates. You know, it definitely lends a problem for the level of obesity and the level of people having problems with diabetes. And, you know, we've taken those things out of our diet, and we talk to people about it, and they're like, absolutely confused about how in the world do you do that. And it's really not that hard, but our food industry and the way that it's just absolutely, you walk into a grocery store, the first thing you see are the cinnamon rolls and things like that. We have to do more to really let people know about the dangers of these types of eating too much sugar and simple carbohydrates. So would you speak to that?
Right. You bring up a good point. And again, this is where, the science can help inform. There's the counter arguments with the marketing of these products and that the information that gets to the public can be quite confusing. Again, I think you said it, that you understand what's needed to be healthy, and what information you're getting and where you're getting that information is critically important. And again, I refer back to the NIH website that does provide that unbiased, objective information on a variety of health conditions, including healthy eating and healthy lifestyle. I will say for NCCIH, what we have found that yoga users, people who practice yoga for whatever reason, we're still trying to figure this out, but over 60% of yoga users report they're more motivated to exercise more regularly, they're more motivated to eat healthier. So engaging in some of these complementary practices like yoga are somehow changing people's perspective and frame on how to live their life, whether it's exercise or eating healthier. They also report improved sleep. So these are some of the preventive strategies that might be useful, at least from a complementary health approach, is engaging in some contemplative practice like yoga and meditation that may get us thinking more about and more aware of what we're eating, how we're eating, what's healthy, what's not healthy, and maybe being less influenced by the larger advertising and other things that are in our environment that may be controlling our behavior even without us even knowing it.
Thanks, Ruth, for the call. Don't you think that most of us have basic information about what's good to eat and what's not, that you shouldn't eat too many cinnamon rolls and chocolate cake, and you should have fruits and vegetables and lean meat? Isn't that pretty commonly available knowledge?
You would think, Kathleen, but again, we're looking at an obesity epidemic in the United States. Again, this is where complementary and integrative health approaches may be useful. Again, the contemplative approaches, meditation, yoga, tai chi, it slows down. It allows us to think and be more aware of what we're doing in real time. And many people, I do it all the time, unfortunately, even though I do practice meditation myself. There's times when I'm under stress and, you know, that bag of potato chips is there, and before you know it, I've eaten most, if not all, of the bag of chips without even thinking.
Sure.
So I think these contemplative approaches and what our research is showing is that they keep people in the present. They keep people aware, the individual aware of what they're doing in real time. And we're also seeing on a biological level that they are changing the brain in ways that make sense in how the cortex sort of controls what we call these limbic, more fundamental, instinctive processes. So there is something to these practices that's changing behavior but also changing the brain.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Don in Eau Claire. Hi, Don.
Hi there. I'll be brief if I can. I happen to be a 92-and-a-half-year-old retired physician.
Wow.
I'm still cognitively pretty sound. I'm not a diabetic, but I do have a severe axonal peripheral neuropathy, which over the course of years has led to Charcot deformities in both feet. And on the right foot, it eventually led to a BK amputation.
Mm.
I don't have neuropathic pains as many people with neuropathy do, except I do have a phantom pain, which in a way is a sort of a neuropathic pain. Mm-hmm. I have regular acupuncture treatment, which does prolong the interval between episodes of phantom pain that I have. And when I do have them, it shortens the interval so that the acupuncture is definitely of some help. At my age, I can subtract the cost of the acupuncture, which insurance will not cover. I can subtract that from my income tax by itemizing my deductions. But the poor individual who is not able to itemize their deductions to the extent I'm able to are stuck with having to pay the insurance company, which will pay for needling of pressure points by a physical therapist, but the insurance company will not cover for the acupuncture.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a distinct inequality there.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if the INH or anyone has made any comparison at all between, in their studies of acupuncture, mm-hmm. whether they've gotten around to evaluating the dry needling done by by physical therapist. Mm.
It's a great question. I'm glad you're finding some benefit, Don, for your pain. We know pain, chronic pain, is a huge problem in the United States. There is a lot of information on our website about acupuncture and comparative research in that area. I will say that there's been a large study out of Germany, actually, to show that when you compare acupuncture to what we call a sham acupuncture or to usual care, acupuncture does show some benefit even relative to the sham, but not very large benefit, but some for particularly back pain and neck pain. So there is at least some evidence to suggest that it can be beneficial. Now, whether this is solely based on the procedure itself or some non-specific factors, it's still ongoing. There's still a lot of ongoing research there, but clearly people are benefiting from this practice. When it comes to insurance, that's something, of course, that NIH is not involved with. We are the research arm. We hope to provide the evidence and information that the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Practices and insurance companies might use to think about whether they will, in fact, reimburse for these complementary approaches.
Has it taken us longer to do more research on something like acupuncture simply because it wasn't a part of our culture until fairly recently?
Well, right. It has, as you know, it's a long tradition in Asia and in China, and it has been in the United States for a while. We at NCCIH have put a significant portion of our research dollars into looking at acupuncture. We're continuing to explore that. In fact, we're also now working and will be working with the Veterans Administration, Department of Defense, who is extremely interested in acupuncture and other complementary health approaches. As you know, since the Iraq war and wars in Afghanistan, many service members are coming back with chronic pain conditions, and conventional opioid therapy is not necessarily benefiting them, and DOD and VA are interested in looking at complementary and integrated approaches. So it's another way for us to look at what works and what doesn't and trying to figure out what's best for individuals with chronic pain.
Hmm. Are veterans hospitals using those approaches now more
they
so
are,
than others?
To some extent, it varies depending on the VA clinic. What we will be doing is collaborating with them on something called pragmatic trials, where we actually use real-world setting to look at integrative health approaches such as acupuncture. There is battlefield acupuncture going on now in the DOD that's being used. So there is some uptake. More research is needed to know exactly what types of approaches work best for what kind of pain. It's probably the case that we'll need an integrative approach with multiple complementary health approaches rather than just a single one. And how we go about managing those efforts will be a challenge, but the research done in a real-world setting will help us answer some of these questions.
More phone calls momentarily. Dr. David Shurtleff is our guest, Deputy Director of the National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health. A study that they have done, a survey, was pretty amazing, looking at the amount of money, out-of-pocket money, that we spend, $30.2 billion on complementary health approaches. And we're looking at why we do that and which ones might be effective and which merit more research, which is being done by the National Institutes of Health. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Thank you, Don, for your call. Our email, talk@wpr.org. You can leave a message on our Facebook page as well, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Okay, back to phone calls for Dr. David Shurtleff. He's Deputy Director of the National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health, William in Spring Green. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I compliment you the program, but I am a doctor of complementary medicine. I'm 86 years old. I retired some years ago, and I did all the things you question, and acupuncture, chiropractic, naturopathy, and so on. And the people I attended to they went to me because they were disappointed with the allopathic medicine, and so and they had the side effects from the drugs, and the symptoms were paramount, and so I all this acupuncture, you know, I should say, it has been proven, and over many years, and the insurance companies paid me for the cost, and it was much less than the allopathies, and I saved a lot of back surgeries, and so. But anyhow, the point I'm making, I have acknowledged that there are a lot of children being subjected, and babies and chips subjected to multiple vaccinations, and there are complications, and they're dying.
All right. I don't want to get into a vaccination debate on this show. It will take us in a whole other direction. But, William, thank you very much for your call. It's interesting. I'm wondering how many doctors there are of complementary medicine, how you become a doctor of complementary medicine. And he had high marks for acupuncture. I'm wondering more about the studies that are on the books right now that really address acupuncture, Dr. Shurtleff.
Right, so we do have an active program in acupuncture, and we are looking at specific sites on the body that may be beneficial. There is actually potentially some good quality physiological research that suggests that certain sites on the body, particularly one area that's particularly intriguing for us, that we'll be doing some work over the next several years, is the ear, the auricular acupuncture. It's sites on the ear that we know through rigorous physiological research connect to the vagus nerve, which, as you know, controls digestive function and other. It's a way of the body communicating with the brain. And there may be some really beneficial effects associated with stimulating that particular site. And of course, what we're interested in is understanding how and what for what conditions it will work for. And that will be an ongoing area of active investigation. And I did mention our work with the DOD and the VA around pain. And I might just mention quickly that NCCIH, a major focus for our research over the last few years and into the future, will be on use of non-pharmacological approaches for pain management.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, Kathleen, it's a huge public health problem.
Yes.
25.3 million American adults suffer from pain daily. Many of them have extreme pain with other health conditions, worse status, need more health care, suffer from more disability, and we really need to get a better understanding of how we can integrate complementary integrative health programs and modalities into management of pain. So that's just something I wanted you and your listeners to know, is that NCCIH has made a concerted effort to increase our research in the area of pain, and in fact, our intramural program here on the Bethesda campus that NIH has devoted solely to understanding the basic mechanisms of pain and potential new targets for treating pain. So I just wanted people to be aware of that.
Don is next in South Milwaukee. Hi, Don.
Hi. I just wanted to share some information that I'm aware of regarding the gentleman that called in that has the phantom limb pain. I don't know if this would fall into alternative or complementary medicine or not, but there's something called mirror therapy, which... there's some research that shows that it helps. I think it was developed by neurologist Vilayanar Ramachandran.
Yes.
And basically the patient sits with a mirror facing the remaining leg and moves the remaining leg and watches the reflection in the mirror so that it looks like both the good and the amputated leg are moving. and the brain gets the signal that any kind of constriction in the leg that was amputated is now no longer there. So I just wanted to pass that along because I, you know, maybe this gentleman could get help with something like that.
Right. That's great insight, Don. It just points to the fact that we think about pain as a sensation, you know, an ache, a sting, a scratch. But a lot of what constitutes pain is actually happening in the brain. And phantom pain is one of a great example where the limb is no longer there, but people are feeling pain. And it's because of the signals arising from the brain itself. And it's an area where we NCCIH is not doing a lot in that area, but we certainly know from some of the work going on that complementary and integrative approaches can be beneficial. Cognitive behavioral therapy, some of the meditative practices may be useful in rewiring, in a sense, the brain so that these signals are not as potent as they are in some patients.
So, Dr. Shurtleff, I don't know if you can answer this or not, but of that $30.2 billion that we're spending out of pocket, how much would you say we're wasting?
That's a hard one to answer, Kathleen. I mean, you know, we don't really know why people are necessarily always using these practices. We know that we did a similar study that just came out in 2015 looking at why people are using yoga and other practices. And a lot of the reasons people are using these approaches is for general wellness or disease prevention. And that's an area that our new strategic plan has just come out. It's on our website. And one of our major focuses is looking at how these approaches may be beneficial in general wellness and disease prevention. But people certainly, for example, who are taking these supplements and using yoga report higher self-reported wellness. So that is the reason they are giving us that they're using them. But when you dig a little deeper and you look at the outcomes, whether they're less stressed, whether they're sleeping better, at least for natural products, we see nothing that they're reporting better, those kinds of improvements in symptoms. But for yoga, there's some indication that there is a better feeling of emotional well-being. So at least for yoga, we can say that this practice has been, at least our research is showing, it has some benefits. For the dietary supplements, at least for self-report, although people are taking these supplements, they're not reporting reduced stress, better sleep, or better feelings of emotionality. So here's an area that certainly needs more rigorous research before we can answer those questions.
Mm. The area is a difficult one, isn't it, too? You never know what kind of study. I mean, yesterday, for heaven's sake, we were told we don't need to floss our teeth. Are you kidding me? Those of us who've been flossing our teeth for years, we should floss our teeth, shouldn't we?
Well, I mean, I think that's why, you know, certainly for the supplement, we've shown positive benefit. You know, we did a study with the National Eye Institute showing that an over-the-counter medication marketed by Bausch and Lomb can reduce or delay macular degeneration. And those products are things that, you know, include vitamin C and vitamin E and zinc. But through rigorous research, we were clearly able to show that this product reduced delayed macular degeneration by 25%.
Yeah. Well, on that note, positive note, we'll say goodbye to you and thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you. Dr. David Shurtleff, Deputy Director of the National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health. Thanks to Kiri Salinas for producing this hour and to Kiri as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. 2 days before the anniversary, 71st anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, Harry Truman's grandson following the news.